So this evening's talk is the second of three in a series about issues involving an integrated path of practice. And it's entitled Markings for Obstacles on an Integrated Path of Practice. And I'll explain what that means, what markings means. And it's basically going to discuss two major things. One is the role of seeking answers or solutions in meditation practice, needing to have an answer. And the second one is going to be about thought and personal narrative, the role that those play in meditation practice. So the talk is not going to be about what to do with thought. That'll be tomorrow morning. And then the talk, my third talk in a couple of days, is going to be about what to do with attachment and identification. Okay. So as a starting place, I had mentioned earlier that there are, at least for me, kind of a handful of people that you can point to that very clearly show that it's possible to have a deeply contemplative life and also be deeply involved in the world. And one of those people was Thomas Merton, who I admire a lot. And another one I was very lucky to kind of discover when I was in the ninth grade, and his name was Dag Hammarskjöld. And Hammarskjöld was the Secretary General of the United Nations during the mid-50s when there was all this hope about the United Nations, and it was also the time period when all of the African states were being released from colonial rule. So it was just a tinderbox politically. And he was a very quiet, effective diplomat, and then his life was cut short when he was killed in a plane crash when he was in Africa doing negotiations. There's all kinds of speculation as to whether or not the plane was sabotaged or not, and nobody knows.
What was his name again?
Dag Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld. So after he died, one of his close friends, who was his executor, was going through his things in his apartment in New York and found a manuscript that I don't think was ever intended to be published. It was his personal notebook of thoughts. And it's fascinating and illuminating, and it showed what not only what a contemplative that he was, but that he was basically a mystic. And so here's this fellow that just appears to be kind of this highly skilled, quiet, international diplomat who has this whole other side to his life that was not made public, and actually, like, very few people at the United Nations even knew about this piece. And that book was published after he died, and it was called Markings. And it was called Markings. This is the translation from the Danish, because he was a hiker and would always hike in the mountains. And in all these little paths, they would put little piles of stones, like a pyramid. And the translation was that those were markings. And so if you knew which way the markings pointed you, you would be able to go the right way. And if you didn't, or didn't understand them, or didn't see it, that you'd go the wrong way, or maybe get in trouble, or maybe fall off the side of the mountain. Okay. So, hence the title of this talk about markings. And I think the issue of our idea of what the role of answers and solutions are, and what we do with thought and our personal narrative are markers. And depending on how we understand that, it either points us in the right direction or it points us in the wrong direction. The other thing I just love about Hammarskjöld was that his very first act when he came in as Secretary General was to convene a meeting of his staff and begin planning a meditation room on the first floor of the United Nations. That was his very first act. And it took them 2.5-3 years for the whole thing to get done, and they created it. And when it was dedicated, he said that in a building dedicated to peace, in the outward sense, there should be at least one room that was wholly devoted to peace in the inner sense. And so even in the ninth grade, that just did something for me, you know, inspirationally. And it was a big wish of mine to be able to get back there and see that and be there and visit it and what have you. It was almost like a pilgrimage to go there, and which I was fortunate enough to do. I spent a whole summer at the United Nations and went to that room every single day when I was there. So let's start with the role of answers and solutions. And I want to be clear that I'm talking about in the meditation process itself. There may be all kinds of things that we do with insights that we have, and then work with thought and ideas. And so I'm talking about the actual insight meditation process, or the Brahmavihara process. So in the moment of meditation, what is the role of answers or solutions? And you know, we live in a culture that loves answers. I think part of the reason for the explosion of the internet is because of that. You know, it's like there's a million answers, or what passes for answers. You know, as long as you've got a computer, right, you've got an opinion, and it doesn't matter whether it's accurate or inaccurate or what it is, biased, it's there and unfiltered. You know, and I feel that a lot of our educational system has actually shifted over to teaching people how to find the right answer rather than think critically. In part, what I think is behind this is a real life experience for all of us, and it's an experience of feeling uncomfortable or discomfort in the face of uncertainty, ambiguity, or confusion. And if you know, if you just think of some of your sittings, you know, like in interviews, a lot of issues coming up, people trying to figure them out, you know. And for many people, it's a painful experience just to sit quietly with an unresolved issue. That, you know, your mind has to go into rumination. It has to figure out how to fix it. It has to figure out how to resolve it. It has to project out into the future. It has to go into the past and recast the past. So I think this need for an answer, you know, to do it right, to have the right answer, to know, is both cognitive and emotional. And, you know, at some level, I think it's almost wired into us, hardwired, because my grandson hasn't gotten to the stage yet, but I know it's coming, where, you know, anything you say or do, it's like, why? Right? And then you give an answer, and then it's why, and then it's why, and it just keeps going, you know. So what is the answer to the dilemma of wanting an answer? And from a Buddhist perspective, because from a Buddhist perspective, you know, it's just the reverse. From a Buddhist perspective, uncertainty, ambiguity, confusion are really prized states of mind if, and this is the big if we can sit with them and we can be with the tension, and stay with them long enough to allow what is to be revealed to us, rather than cutting it off, rather than moving into rumination or thought to try to fix it or correct it or figure it out. So I'd like to start with a couple of quotations that I really love, and one is from a photographer named David Ehrlich, and he really a beautiful photographer. He works mostly in black and white, and a number of years ago he was in Hawaii on a vacation, and he was out in the out country and was chopping wood, and a piece of wood came off and went right in, not in his eye this way, but right in the bottom of his eye here, and then went through the skin into his eye. And although they were able to save the eye, they were unable to save his sight. So, you know, for a very sensitive photographer, it's like this huge loss. And I didn't know this, but they actually have courses for people that if you lose the sight of one eye, you know, everything kind of changes, and they put you through a course on how to see with one eye, depth perception, everything. And he wrote a book about seeing, and his viewpoints and what he has to say, I don't know if he's a Buddhist, but they are completely congruent, and they're usually very poetic. So here's the starting place, because where I want to go with this is something that seems pretty mundane and something that we've heard before, and I believe is absolutely radical in terms of a fundamental piece of our practice. So Ehrlich says, it may be stating the obvious, but we do see what we want to see. What we call seeing, you know, and here we're talking about seeing clearly, right? That's the refrain in our practice. What we call seeing is generally a reflection of our inner dialogue, which is constant and unceasing. Our inner dialogue tends to support our particular worldview, our image of ourself, and our subjective beliefs. We have our own agendas, our predisposed attitudes, and our own cultural biases. We rarely see the world in a fresh way, or our experience in a fresh way, or question the numerous and often unconscious filters that influence our perception. Moments of real seeing are beyond what we think we know. Moments of real seeing are beyond what we think we know. And you know, the nature of insight, which is the, you know, the crowning jewel of this practice, insight or wisdom, usually is that. It's beyond what we know. It's beyond what we expect. It's a surprise. So, you know, like people are reporting in interviews things that have come up, and it's kind of like, that's the last thing in the world that I would have thought would have come up. And the reason is that our entire mind-body system has a wisdom. You know, you'll come into a retreat thinking, well, there's this big issue I need to work on. And then it just doesn't happen during the retreat, and something else comes up. And what gets revealed intuitively is what we actually need to work on. The product of the wisdom of our own body and mind. So this idea that when we sit down, that how we approach our sitting and what we expect in our sitting is biased by an agenda, by what we've learned, by what we hope is going to happen, is a huge issue. And a lot of the insight work is actually seeing through the assumptions that we're making and governing our life that aren't obvious to us. Okay. So the second quotation is from a woman who I think she's dead now. I should have checked. but her name is Jean de Saltzman, a French woman. And she was one of, you may have heard of Gurdjieff, who was an Eastern European mystic. And to this day, you know, there's a huge following all around the world, and they have what are called Gurdjieff houses. So when I was in law school, my best buddy had also been my best buddy in college, was living in a Gurdjieff house, and I was becoming a Buddhist. So we'd always be comparing notes, okay? And you know, the whole Gurdjieffian approach is a little more mystic. It's a little more detached than what we do, but there's a lot of similarities, and it's very powerful stuff. And this woman was part of his inner circle. She established the Gurdjieff Center in New York City and the Gurdjieff Institute in Paris, France. So she says, so long as I have not seen the nature and movement of my own mind, there is little sense in believing that I could be free of it. So long as I have not seen the nature and movement of my mind, there is little sense in believing that I could be free of it. Because what would be the basis for believing that? You know, I think it's faith. But that's basically what we're doing. We're trying to see the nature and the movement of the mind at its most basic level, that either causes us to suffer or points our mind towards happiness. I am a slave to my thoughts. This is a fact. But it is not my thoughts themselves that enslave me, but my attachment to them. This is a huge thought, a huge reality. Okay, it is not the thoughts themselves that enslave me, but my attachments to them. So we feel like we're plagued by, sometimes, by our thoughts. And that's not what's plaguing us. What's plaguing us is that we're attached and identified and can't let them go. So, I mean, why do we have whole group of people who have been through terrible events? And part of them are fine. They've let it go. They're completely healthy. They've healed. It's been resolved. And there's another group, and they're just tortured by it till the day they die. There's this interesting study about Holocaust survivors. And I had seen this, and then I heard Saki Santarelli back at UMass, who now heads the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. He's talked about this. And it was a study that was done of a large number of Holocaust survivors. And basically what the study showed was that about 80% of them were scarred for life. That they had deep memories that continued to plague them, deep fears, and that there were about 20% of them that did not happen. That whatever they did, that they were healed, that, you know, they ran all these psychological tests on them, that they were healthy, that they weren't carrying that all around. And Saki said, the first time he heard about this, the speaker said this about the 80% and then continued on to talk about the 80%. And he said, hey, I want to know about the 20%. Like, what in the world did those people do in the face of something like that, you know, to be healthy? And from a Buddhist perspective, I mean, we can make it real complex, but the answer is that in some way they were able to give up the attachment and identification with those experiences and allow that to heal them. So she goes on, our conditioned thoughts always want an answer. What is important is to develop another kind of thinking, actually a way of seeing. For this, we have to liberate certain energy that is beyond our usual way of thinking. And here's the key part. I need to experience I do not know without seeking an answer. I need to experience I do not know without seeking an answer to abandon everything to enter the unknown of my own mind. If I do this, then it is no longer the same mind. My mind engages in a new way. I see without any preconceived idea, without any choice. So, you know, we've all heard, you know, in Zen practice they talk about beginner's mind, or I don't know mind. And it's like, well, okay, you know, I've heard that. But if you really think about this, this is like, an extraordinary, radical idea. That, like, in the next sitting, you would sit down and actually say to yourself, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, like, maybe something important is going to happen in the next sitting. You know, we normally sit down and kind of have an idea of what's going to happen. I'm going to follow my breath, and you know, maybe it'll be tough, maybe it won't. Maybe my leg will hurt, maybe it won't. But the range, you know, that we're holding of what may be possible has a fence around it. So this idea that we would actually say to ourselves, I actually don't know, and what this actually means, and what in the Zen tradition don't know mind is, and is I actually don't know, I actually don't know why I'm continuing to suffer. Because if we did, we'd stop suffering. I mean, it's like in black and white. I mean, if we actually knew, would anyone here say, okay, I vote to continue to suffer. Sign me up. That's what I want to do. I like this stuff. So, I mean, in the most profound way, this sounds so ordinary, but it has this profound thing behind it. Is we, despite all of our work, at some level we actually don't know. And when we sit down in meditation, we have the possibility of knowing or beginning to know. I mean, the most exciting thing possible. And so how could we hold that? I mean, how could we bring that? You know, we have to want that. You know, somehow we have to build that into our practice or it'll just disappear. It won't be one of the attitudes that we hold. So in long-term practice, and in sitting, in the moment of sitting itself, while we're sitting, we're not looking for functional answers. We're not looking for functional solutions. We're trying to see into the nature of the mind. You know, in the Buddha, in the Satipatthana Sutra, the four foundations of mindfulness repeated over and over again, that there are three things that, in order for the mind to be liberated, we need to see. The first one is what causes a mind state to arise. Internally, what causes it to arise? What causes it to be sustained or to intensify? And then what causes it to go away? Those three things. Okay. Another way of saying that is what causes our mind to go into reactivity, to stay in reactivity or to intensify, and for the reactivity to disappear. Another way of saying it is what causes, what conditions, because it's all about conditions, what conditions lead to the mind falling into satisfaction and happiness and sustaining that, or that intensifying, or that disappearing. So if we actually knew those things, we could actually find our way out of suffering. And another thing that may seem obvious, but it's not, is that the type of happiness that we're looking for in Buddhist practice is a happiness and satisfaction that is not dependent on external circumstances. Okay? Satisfaction and happiness are peace that is not dependent on external circumstances. So our mind is usually looking for the answer in some sense outside of ourselves, and certainly frequently blaming outside circumstances or things that have happened to us as the cause of our suffering. And the peace and satisfaction that is the end product of this practice is a peace and satisfaction that is not dependent on external circumstances. So, if we were actually able to answer those three things, you know, what causes a mind state to arise, sustain, intensify, or move, all the functional answers would take care of themselves. You know, all these, how do I fix this, how do I fix that, that would be the easy part. Okay? Without answering, without learning through direct experience, those three things, reactivity, happiness, what we end up doing is learning a lot of techniques and methods that give us short-term relief from what's troubling us. So we're looking for a long-term solution here. That takes a long term to get the long-term solution. You know, it's slow going. But it's important to understand that what the practice is not about is just trying to find a Band-Aid and keep slapping a Band-Aid on. I've got some anxiety right now, or I've got some pain in my back. That's part of it. But the real goal is this long-term result that's not dependent on external circumstances. So that leads me to a thought and a personal narrative. And I'm going to start with a story here that I heard Joseph Goldstein tell a long time ago, so I may have just a few of the details on this wrong, but the basic message is completely right. So after he had been practicing for a long, long time, much longer than anyone in this room, and had all written several books and was basically an internationally recognized figure, he started practicing in other traditions. So he had already gone to Asia and practiced with, you know, a lot of the real living legends, including Sayadaw Upandita, who just died recently, who was a Kamala Masters and Stephen Armstrong's one of their core teachers. But that was in the tradition, you know. So he did work with Tibetan teachers, and he worked with a very famous Zen teacher and did a sesshin, which is basically the Zen version of a retreat. And in this school, in some schools of Zen, they do what's called a koan. So it's a question that doesn't have an apparent answer. So like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? So, you know, they sit for a couple of days, and then you go in, and the teacher gives you a koan. So they give Joseph a koan, and then you're supposed to come back in 2 days. So, you know, he's thinking about this koan, working on it, and he thinks, well, you know, I've got a pretty good answer, you know. So he goes in and sits down in front of the teacher, and the teacher repeats the koan, and Joseph gives his answer, and the teacher says, stupid. And he hits the bell, and that means the interview's over. Stupid hits the bell. So he goes and, you know, works on it for a couple more days, and you know, now he's kind of getting anxious. you know, because like, you know, even as humble as he is, if you've ever seen him teach or anything, you know, it's like, well, you know, I kind of know what I'm doing, you know. It's like, so second time he goes in, he's feeling like really confident, you know, and he gives the answer, and the master says, stupid, gets the bell. So it goes in the third time, same thing. So by this time, you know, his report is that, you know, like he's basically a nervous wreck, you know, and despite all of his training, his ability to kind of like keep this anxiety under control has just gone out of control. So the fourth time he goes in, he sits down, and the master says, what is it? And he starts to give the answer, and he just starts crying. You know, he's so frustrated. And the teacher says, good. You know. So in that tradition, the purpose of a koan is to exhaust the rational mind. You know, I mean, it's a very explicit thing that we're going to exhaust your rational mind, and then the intuitive mind, the intuitive wisdom of your body and itself can come forward, okay? So what is the purpose, the meaning of this story? Does it mean that tomorrow Diane and Rich and I and our interviews are going to start calling you stupid? I hope not. Does it mean that we're going to try to figure out how to make you really frustrated and break down and cry? No. But what it does do is it points to the issue of what this practice is shooting for. It's not shooting for answers from the rational mind. You know, a rational mind, our rational mind will never answer the question, what is the sound of one hand clapping, or what did your face look like before you were born? Not going to happen. Not going to happen, okay? Equally, our rational or cognitive mind will never be able to provide us with an answer that will give us a lasting peace to questions like this. Why did my parents do that? Why did a particular thing happen to me earlier in my life? Why do I keep hurting myself and other people? Why can't I stop self-judgment, self-criticism, and self-deprecation? Why can't I let go of these painful memories? Why do I keep wanting something that I know is impossible to obtain? So the rational mind will never answer these questions. You know, those of us who have been in therapy know that you can know the causes from your family of origin of why you have certain habits. I mean, exquisite knowledge, and still suffer from those habits and patterns. You know. So Upandita, who I had mentioned just a minute ago, you know, who is considered kind of be a giant in all of the core Vipassana teachers of our generation, went over and practiced with him. This is what he says about this issue. He says, people in the West have been educated since kindergarten to use their intellects always to seek the whys and wherefores of suffering. Unfortunately, this kind of investigation is inappropriate for meditation. Intellectual learning and knowledge is only one kind. The other means of knowledge of, and learning is direct and intuitive knowledge that we gain through meditation. In meditation, one examines the ultimate realities of the way the mind works. One must actually experience them without thinking about them. This is the only way to attain insight and wisdom relating to things as they really are, the natural state of affairs and the natural state of our own mind. One may understand a lot intellectually about ultimate reality. One may have read a great deal, but without experiencing reality directly and the reality of their mind, there can be no insight. So, I think for a whole group of people, when you start using language like intuition and, you know, intuitive mind and intuitive wisdom, there's kind of some suspicion about it. It's not really understandable. And part of the reason is that the rational mind doesn't understand it, because it is beyond the rational mind. So, after World War II, post-World War II, there was a Frenchman whose name at the moment I'm blanking on, but he did a survey of all of the physicists who were responsible for, you know, these incredible advances in science, which, you know, led to so many things later. And so, you know, Niels Bohr and Einstein and the whole group. And basically what the project was about was to discover through this questionnaire that's like 37 or 38 questions, how is it that they came to their discoveries? You know, how did they have the aha moment that broke through? So, you know, they're all physicists. They're all quantum physicists, which is basically advanced mathematics. You know, so the assumption was is that what was going to come back from all of these people, both men and women, was something that was very orderly and logical and kind of mathematical, you know, about the way they got to their discoveries. So almost to a person, and I think that they sent the questionnaires to, I think, to 60 of them, and 47 responded. Almost to a person, they said that these spontaneous discoveries, when things just came together and like all these strands that were there which you couldn't see suddenly came together into a single answer, initially came to them either as sensations in their body, kinetic sensations, or as imagery that they then had to sit with and interpret into language or numbers or figures. It's fascinating, you know. And Einstein said that when he looked at all of his major discoveries, that he could not identify any of those in terms of language or concepts that you normally associate with describing a discovery. He said that they all came to him primarily as images or feelings. And he said that his theory of relativity first came to him in a waking dream when he saw himself riding a beam of light across the universe. That started this waking dream that led to a series of images that ended up being that groundbreaking theory. Okay. So the other thing that was fascinating was that they said that none of them had a method for making that happen. Not a single one. You know, because that was like, how do you do this? You know, we want to set up a model and teach people and whatever. To a man and a woman, they said, we don't know. All we know is that it usually happens after we become really frustrated and put everything down and taken a break, or at completely, ostensibly, odd and random moments like stepping on a bus. You know, and they said we don't know how we do it, other than we know we put in a great deal of exertion intellectually And then we step away from it, and somehow our mind coalesces all this material together. So that's intellectual insight, okay? So the difference between that kind of insight and what we do is that our practice has a specifically designed set of practices and a specific psychology whose purpose is to generate insight and wisdom. That's the purpose of it. That's where liberation comes from. That we slowly do these practices and learn them, and then at some point, after training and development of skill and everything, it begins to slowly lead towards the development of wisdom. And the type of wisdom and the type of insights that we have become progressively more powerful. And so it is not an accident that insight arises. It is a specific product of a specific psychology and a specific set of practices that the historical Buddha developed. So it is gradual, it is slow, it absolutely has its own time, it can be very frustrating, and it leads to transformation and awakening and liberation. And I'm not a poster boy for anything about transformation, and I have lots of my own issues, but on this particular topic, the only experience I can speak from is my own. And what I can say is that the person who started this practice over 30 years ago and the person who's sitting here today, internally, I almost can't recognize that person. And, you know, like we're talking about doing these compassion practices for ourselves, I have so much compassion for the person who started this practice 30 years ago. That person was in such suffering. And on the outside, you know, looked like very successful, you know, fast track on just about everything. And it was all, a front that you're holding up against all of your fears and insecurities and doubts and grief and so, you know, as like a very dinky little illustration, it's part of the reason that I have so much faith in this practice. This is one of the many reasons that I do, is that I've seen in my own life the degree of suffering that it's eliminated. I still have all kinds of suffering in my life. I still have lots of dysfunction. But, you know, compared to 30 years ago, I mean, really, so when I do compassion for myself, I start with who that young man was, you know, and every time it kind of breaks my heart. So, in the moment of meditation, okay, when we're actually meditating, exploring the content of thought doesn't have a role. Okay, in the moment of our actual sitting. In the moment of our actual sitting, exploring the content of our personal narrative doesn't have a role. Even when we're doing metta, we're not exploring content. We're trying to counterbalance the mind against its attachment, identification with anger, resentment, grief, remorse, all of these different qualities. That's not to say that we don't do a bunch of things with thought. The point I'm making is that in the moment of our meditating, an exploration of content is not part of the process. That's what Upandita was very clearly saying. In fact, that gets in the way of insight arising. So the Buddha in a sutta called the Honeyball Sutta. It's called the Honeyball because there's this tasty little treat that they make in India, which and I have had together, and it's rice and honey and some little spices, and it's delicious and it's really sticky. Okay, so like once you eat that thing, you know, then you try to like take it out of this hand, and now this hand's sticky, and so the sutta is about thought, and in the sutta, the Buddha says that thought and memory, meaning the content of thought and memory, are the mind's primary defense against feeling in the body. So that when we have a strong emotion or we have a strong thought that has an emotion attached to it, and you know it starts to flower in our body and it's really painful, that the mind's primary defense is to move from here up into our head and go into identification. The whole second half of the sutta is about going into identification, and as a result, I'm disassociated, I'm disconnected with my body, and now I get caught in the drama of rumination, memory, and thought, and it's the reason things seem so confusing and we feel trapped when this happens is that we're just completely disconnected from our body, you know, and the place that where we could ground ourselves and break that cycle, once you're caught in that, you don't, unless you've trained yourself, you don't even think to do it, right? Like, you're so dramatic. And then in another sutta, he would always give, he lived in an agrarian culture, you know, I mean, there were still actually jungles in India at that time, you know, so there's stories about him and the other monks, you know, camping for the night in a jungle and hearing lions and stuff, you know. So he uses a lot of very simple little analogies and stories about animals. So one that he uses is about a falcon and a quail. And the story is about basically who's the smarter, you know. And the way the story's set up as well, obviously the quail is not the smarter of the two. Okay. The falcon is so powerful. So the falcon's up and he's, you know, hovering, the quail's down here. The falcon dives, you know, and how fast they can dive. He's coming down and the little quail is right here. And what the falcon doesn't know is that the quail is standing in front of a rock. Okay. So the falcon comes down and then right at the last minute, the quail just steps out of the way. And the falcon, rather than grabbing the quail, slams into the rock and kills himself. Okay? So, in this little story, the thought is the falcon. Okay? And that the avoidance of getting caught in rumination, story, and thought is the moral to the story. It's a story that is the equivalent of the message in the Honeyball Sutta. So, in the moment of meditation, you know, as I was talking about my brother-in-law having this idea that in a busy parking lot, if you imagine that there's a parking space, one will appear for you. You know, one of the basic messages of Buddhist practice is that things are different than they appear. You know, we think we do something and we're doing it because it makes us feel good, and then at some point in practice we realize actually it's making us suffer. You know, it's actually a defense against something else. It's compensatory behavior, and we didn't know that. So there's all these things that things are different than they are. So in the moment of meditation, the goal is understanding, not to find a solution or an answer, but actual understanding of the process of the mind. And if we can see how things arise, sustain, and dissipate, and we start to get some traction. So the big part about this in relationship to thought and the personal narrative is that it is our attachment and identification with thought, with a particular memory or a particular event in the past, that is the cause of our suffering, not the thought, not the particular event, not something that happened. Things may have happened to us that were terrible, but that's not the cause of our suffering. You know, that story about the Holocaust survivors makes that pretty clear. These terrible things that can happen to us, one group of people actually heal from it, and other people don't. And from a Buddhist perspective, why? That's the difference between seeing into the nature of the mind and dealing with the true cause. And the true cause is our identification and attachment with thought. Now, in Buddhist practice, a memory or an image of the past is considered a thought. And actually, from a Buddhist perspective, there's not anything that's very unique about it. The thing that's unique about it is that it tortures us. That's why it's different than other kinds of thought. But how thought itself works, a memory about a terrible event, does not operate any differently than a thought about some annoyance, the annoyance that I was having with the leaf blower before the session started. They are of the same kind. The difference is the degree of attachment and identification which results in the intensity of our suffering. This is huge. And to the rational mind, it's not obvious. You know, as Upandita said, you know, from kindergarten, we've been taught that we can find an answer, that there's an intellectual answer, and that most of the time the cause of our suffering is outside of ourselves. So if it's true that the end game of this practice is to find a peace and satisfaction that is not dependent on external circumstances, then the answer to our suffering isn't outside of us. It's internally, and particularly what we do with our thoughts. And why do thoughts and memories and images of the past torment us so much? It's not because of the thought. It's not because of the image. It's because of our attachment and identification to it. Now, this actually, I think, is something that our rational mind does not want to believe. We actually believe that the reason we're being tormented is because of a thought or a memory or something that happened to us. I mean, we really believe that. That's what this culture believes. That's what Western psychology is built on. Okay? That is not the foundation of the Buddhist psychology of suffering. And so, you know, in my own small way, you know, the difference between when I first started to practice, my brother, who I was very close with, had gone into training for the Vietnam War, and it just took him apart. It just took him apart. And so from when I was a freshman in high school until 3 days before I graduated from college, he was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. This is my stepbrother, my half-brother. He recovered, got on his feet, got married, had a beautiful little child, relapsed, completely destroyed his marriage, completely destroyed his relationship with his family, and then 3 days before I graduated from college, killed himself. Okay. So in that kind of formative period of high school and college, it really challenged every idea I had about, you know, what's normal, what is healthy, how the mind works, whether I could trust my own mind. And it really, it was really a source of suffering for me and plagued me. And when I first started Buddhist practice, it was a big, big part of my life. Huge piece. And now, although I'm sad about it, I mean, I'm sad about his death, all of those issues are resolved. I mean, I have no attachment at all to the ideas that were causing me so much suffering for 10, like 18 years of my life. And it's just so clear that the reason I'm not suffering and that I feel okay now and that I understand it completely is that I'm no longer attached or identified with any of those ideas, and more importantly, any of those anxieties and fears. So, and as much as I know that, still I'll bump into things and I'll very clearly understand that my mind is believing that the reason I'm suffering isn't because of attachment or identification. It's because somebody did something to me or because I just can't stop thinking something, you know. So, I would really like you to reflect on this idea. Because I think this is as radical as the idea of every time we sit down actually saying to ourselves, I don't know what's about to happen. I mean, like, maybe the next breath, you know, when I sit down, there could be this enormous shift. This, if we could really grasp this, completely shifts our entire understanding of suffering and our entire understanding of why we suffer in relationship to events and other people. It is really foundational. So I would really encourage you to think about this, that the cause of our suffering is our identification and attachment with ideas, not the ideas themselves, not our memories, or the events which led to the thoughts or the memories. The events are long over. I mean, you know, my brother killed himself in 1968. That's gone. That's over. You know? And so my suffering related to something that old is not the event itself. It's what I'm doing with it now, today, in this moment, right now. Right? So the Dalai Lama said, and I'm wrapping up now. The Dalai Lama said, and I really love this quotation. He said, the suffering and happiness each of us experiences is a reflection of the distortion or clarity with which we view ourselves and the world. So this is another way of saying what the suffering and happiness each of us experiences is a reflection of the distortion or clarity with which we view ourselves in the world. So the reality is that a lot of our suffering is a question of choice and training and skill. Are we willing, like this last idea, the true cause is identification and attachment, not the idea or the event? You know, are we really willing to own that? Because in the end, Buddhist practice is about being fully responsible for our internal life and our own suffering. Fully responsible for our suffering. Because it's our relationship to whatever enters our life that is the suffering. So I think it takes a deep commitment to explore these things and actually want to have a transformation of how we understand the way our mind works and how we suffer. And that's a combination of, you know, study and talks like this, and then reflecting on and exploring it, and then practicing it and seeing if it's true. I mean, you can test it out tomorrow, right? Thought starts happening, okay? Like, what does that feel like in the body? You know, when it really starts doing this rumination. I mean, do you feel nice and open and loose and warm, or does your body start to contract and hold on? Well, that's an indication of attachment, right? And anytime your mind is going, I, in relationship to anything you're thinking, you're into identification, you know? So the minute you see that, you know from a Buddhist perspective where you've gone, you know, and that you're actually in the causes of suffering. So I think we have these markers on the path, you know, that actually we don't know, or at least don't know fully why we're suffering. And like actually sitting with that, fully owning it, allowing that to be a motivator that maybe part of the not knowing is confusion based on habitual habits of what the cause of our suffering really is, and watching and seeing that our mind keeps wanting to say that thoughts and external events are the cause of our suffering. A deeply ingrained thing that we need to see and then start to retrain our mind. And I think these two markers are some of the markers, but two of the more powerful ones on the road to transformation. I think if we can really get a foothold with these two, that we have the possibility of really making some movement against these deep entrenched states of mind and ways of thinking that causes suffering. So let's sit for just a second.